Welcome to Healing Place Church, where our mission is to be a healing place for a hurting world. We hope to enrich your life through reaching, serving, giving, and building. As you listen to this teaching, be inspired to fulfill your God-given destiny through the power of His Word.
Well, good morning. How many of you guys love your pastor? Do you love your pastor? Yeah, that was a little weak. How many of you love your pastor? You love your pastor? All right. I do too. I love this church. This is one of my favorite churches in the whole world. I don't tell everybody that. It's true. I love this church. I love your pastor. Dino and DeLynn are some of the most gracious, hospitable. They are known all over the world. You guys don't even know how blessed you are to be led like you are led. I just absolutely love. There are a lot of things I love about Dino. I call him Father Teresa. He's got such a big heart. He's always giving. I like the fact that he doesn't wear skinny jeans. I mean, Jason was up here. He looked good in skinny jeans. There are some people, God did not make us for skinny jeans. You have to be in shape for skinny jeans. I am a shape. I'm a pear, and that's all right. And somebody said, are you on television? I said, no, I have a face for radio. You understand what I'm saying? Jensen Franklin looks great on TV. Some of us, we know our place. And so that's what we do. But I love Dino. Absolutely love him. He's my buddy. He's my friend. He introduced me to LSU football. I want to clarify a little bit of what he said. I am an LSU fan. I became that about 3 or 4 years ago. They took me to an LSU game here. There is nothing like that in the world. I didn't know how to act, okay? All right, let me tell you just a couple of stories, all right? Then we'll get into it. We'll get the message. You'll be all right. But I go to South Carolina games. I am a Gamecock fan. I'm an LSU fan every week except for when they play South Carolina. Then I hope they get beat like a two-year-old at Walmart. But I am an LSU fan most of the time. And we're different in South Carolina is how we go to the games. South Carolina, I'm from Colorado originally, been in South Carolina, planted a church 23 years ago. Started going to South Carolina games. And I remember my first game when something went a way that I didn't think it should, a call or something. I stood up, I started booing, you know, I'm booing and booing. And a guy that brought me, sit down. He said, we don't do that in South Carolina. We don't boo people. South Carolina is a very polite place. It's always every year. Charleston's voted as like the most polite city in the world. It's a polite place. So we don't boo people. We cheer our people. We do not boo other people. And so at South Carolina Stadium, we don't boo people. We just cheer. I come to LSU. It was against Auburn. Seriously. They started booing the Auburn band when they came in. They're just booing, boo. And then Auburn was beating them at halftime. They start booing the LSU team. I think that's a year LSU like won a national championship or something. What does that look like? But anyway, so they're booing them. And then at the end of this game, right at the end, we're sitting right up the end zone. They didn't put out a lot of money for the tickets, but we're sitting right up in the nosebleed, right at the end zone. And LSU threw a touchdown right at the end. Do you remember that game? Right at the end. All of a sudden, everybody in the stadium singing something about, hey, baby. They're dancing. I don't know what hey, baby has to do with football, but they're dancing. I was kissed and hugged by more Cajun men than I'm comfortable with. These are not the people that brought me. These are just people around me. They're smelling of things that they've been drinking. And at that moment, in that moment, it's almost like a salvation experience. In that moment, I became an LSU fan. I did. Every week, except for when they play South Carolina. And this year, fear the chicken. That's all I'm going to say about that. Fear the chicken. Okay? All right, are we friends? All right. Love your staff, world-class staff. They took me fishing. It wasn't even fair. The redfish had no chance, and it was so much fun. Mark Clary's a good friend of mine. Pray for Mark on that Notre Dame addiction that he has, but it's good. Let me tell you about myself just a little bit, and then we'll get into the word. It's always good to kind of share stories, isn't it, a little bit? I am married to the love of my life, honestly. Every day is not a good day. We have bad days, but we have more good days than bad days. I'm just being real. How many of you know that? I hate it when somebody gets up, we never fight, and I say, you know, you make me sick. We do. We love each other. We fight through this stuff, and it's great. I hope she's not watching. She's loved my life. 35 years we've been married this year, and we started liking each other 40 years ago. We were like 6 years old, and we started liking each other. We've been married 35 years. We have 4 children. The oldest one is, I'm just going to give you approximations here. She keeps the data, but the oldest one is about 33. Youngest one's about 28. They all live in Charleston, South Carolina. They all work in some capacity at Seacoast Church. I brought Joshua, my son, with me today. He pray for him. He's a Clemson fan. And he traveled with me today. And but the greatest thing about my kids, I want to tell you something. The greatest thing about my kids are they produced 9 wonderful grandchildren for me. And I think we have a picture. The oldest... somebody's counting over there. Are there 9? There's 9. The oldest one is 4 years old. If you're not blonde-headed, you don't belong in our family. And you say, how did you get them? This is Easter. How did you get them to sit in that chair? Now, those of you who are mothers, how many of you are mothers here right now? You know that this was a moment in time. There was chaos before this moment. There was chaos after this moment. There are mothers all around ready to catch the kids. Oldest one is a boy, youngest one's a boy, and there's 7 girls in between. So pray for our family if you would. It's interesting. Just one more thing. I just wrote a book, and it's called Irreverent: Christianity Without the Pretense, Faith Without the Facade. It just came out. In fact, it's not being released until September 28th. Nationally, and we just got our hands on it this week. This is the first church my church doesn't even have it yet. And so this weekend, we had the publisher ship some books for you guys, tell you just a little bit about the book. I'll tell you this. Years ago, when I first started preaching, I had a preaching mentor, and I asked him, what makes a good sermon? He said 3 things. Make them laugh, make them cry, give them Jesus. He said, if you can make them laugh, make them cry, and give them Jesus, it's going to... And so I've tried to do that. Don't always do that, but that's my goal. And that's what I try to do with this book. If you read it, it will make you laugh, it will make you cry, and it will give you Jesus. Now, what's cool about it is I'm ADD, and most books are not meant for people like me. I never read a book all the way through. I don't want to read it consecutively. So I wrote a book like that. You can start anywhere you want to in here. It makes no difference whatsoever. You start the chapters, they don't relate to one another. You can start anywhere you want to. They're stories about people. And like this. Like, if you are single, how many of you are single? Single adults. Or how many of you are parents that have kids in the home? This book, let me tell you about the book. I'm not used to doing this. I've never had a book before. This is kind of fun. I feel like a salesman. It costs about what 3 cups of coffee at Starbucks would cost. Okay, that's what it is. And the chapter in here on sex is worth at least 1 of the cups, if not 2. It will make you laugh. If you're single, it will make you cry. And it will give you Jesus. Okay, and so that's all I'm going to say about that. And here's what I'd love to happen with the book. People have asked me, what do you want to do with the book? Honestly, I want you to buy it. I want you to read it. I want you to like it. It's unlike any other book out there that I know of. I've never seen a Christian book like this. And I want you to like it. And then here's what I really want you to do. I want you to either buy another copy or take the copy that you have and give it to an unchurched family member or friend. Because I think it will be an introduction to Christianity unlike any they've ever had. So anyway, that's my book. And I'll be signing some copies. I've never signed copies of a book before. So I'm going to do it the first time here, right here, after the service out here somewhere. So anyway, let's do this. Grandparents, how many grandparents are on the front row right here? Would you like a book? Good, here. Well, I don't want to throw it at you. Come on. Somebody else. There you go, right here. And how about over here? We have one? Okay, right here. Right here. Don't be looking at the sex chapter while I'm preaching. Okay? All right, there we go. Thank you. All right. Good. All right, give them a hand. Will you give them a hand? There we go. All right. All right. I'm all about kids. I know it's an old thing, but if I'd have known this season of my life, having grandkids was so good, we'd have just skipped having kids and jumped right to this one. We really would have. I love the children. How many of you have ever wished that you had the energy and innocence of a child? Have you? You know, two things that children are not thinking about. First, they're not thinking about what anybody else is thinking about them. They really don't care. And secondly, they're not thinking about limits. Nothing is impossible when you're three. You can do anything. All you got to do is get Mario Brothers superpowers. And you can do whatever you want to. And I got to tell you, my family, we try to go out to eat after church on Sunday. And we can bus up a restaurant. We can. When they see us coming, it's like, oh my goodness. And it's always fun. There's usually a meltdown or two. There's going to be snot flinging everywhere. The food is going to, you're going to be wearing some of the food. You know, that's just how we roll. But it's so much fun. And let me tell you what else they can do. They are liable to break out into a dance at any time. Seriously. The ones that walk around, you have a certain song come on that they like on a radio, doesn't matter where it is, and you see their little behinds and their little, you know, they're doing this and they're just dancing. And we have a first Wednesday service at our church where we have like an hour and a half of nothing but worship. And they'll bring the little Surratts in there. And I'm on the front row like Dylan is here. And they'll bring them in for part of the worship. And I mean, these little blondes are just, they're digging it. I mean, I'm like real self-conscious about that. I don't have rhythm or anything. There's not a bit of self-conscious in them at all. They will dance at the drop of a hat. Let me ask you, when did we lose that? At what age do we lose this sense of awe and wonder? When did it happen for you? When you started caring more about what other people were thinking? When you started thinking more about limits than possibilities? When did that happen? When did that happen? When did we quit breaking into spontaneous dance? When I was a kid growing up, I didn't want to be a preacher. My dad was a preacher. I wanted to be a rock star. That was my goal in life. You need talent in order to be that. And I didn't have it, but that's never stopped a Surratt, lack of talent. And so I had a band, and we played all over the place. And obviously, I didn't make it as a rock star. It wasn't in my future. But some of the guys did. And one of them, actually, country music is where he made his mark. And his name's Brent. And Guitar Magazine calls him the greatest guitar player in the world. And he's played on more. He's the most recorded country guitar player in the history of Nashville. And so we grew up in this little church. And it's kind of funny that would happen to him. But anyway, I had him come to preach at my church. Not preach, but play music at my church here a few months ago. And we sat down, we played together, and then I had a Q&A, and I said, Brent, you need to tell the people. People are asking, was I really as good as I say that I was growing up? And Brent said, well, there are two types of musicians in Nashville. There are those that have talent and those that have equipment. And he said, you had equipment. And probably good to stay with my day job. But anyway, Brent has a home in Nashville. He also has a home in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. And every summer, July the 4th, he does a concert there. It's really a big deal in Steamboat. And then usually they'll have a bonfire up at his house that overlooks the valley that the Steamboat is in. And he's invited me several times to go to it. And four years ago, Joshua and I and Joshua's brother Jason, we went to the bonfire. And Brent said, you know, bring a guitar if you got one. We're all going to sit around and just a few friends, and we're going to just play some music. And so I went, and there maybe 15 or 20 of us, and we're at this bonfire, and it's just so cool. And after a while, he says, okay, he says, several of you have written music. He says, what I'd like you to do is I would like you to play a song that you've written that maybe some of us have heard on the radio. And these were not like the people that sang the songs. These are the ones that have written songs. He said, and first tell the story behind why you wrote what you did. I thought, well, that'll be interesting. And the first one was a girl named Tia. And Tia said, you know, I had this breakup, nasty breakup. I was married and went through a divorce. I didn't want it. It was terrible. And she said, I felt totally lost. She said, I was sitting on just by the beach in Florida and feeling all alone and so insignificant. And she said, one of my buddies called me from Colorado. And she said, he invited me to come out, knew how I was feeling. So I drove out to Colorado. And to get to Steamboat, I had to drive over the mountains, decided to go over Trail Ridge Road. If you've ever been over Trail Ridge Road in Colorado, it's incredible. 13,000 feet, highest paved road in America. And I have fear of heights. And so even talking about it, my hands start to sweat. And I always like to go over it, but I never look. You know, it's like I'm white knuckling the steering wheel. And she said, you know, she's going over this mountain and she's nervous and afraid. And it's a metaphor for her life. She's afraid of what's going on. She got to her friend's house and she said, I sat down and I wrote the words to this song. Let's see if you've ever heard this song. It goes like this. I hope you never lose your sense of wonder. You get your fill to eat, but always keep that hunger. May you never take one single breath for granted. God forbid love ever leave you empty-handed. I hope you still feel small when you stand by the ocean. Whenever one door closes, I hope one more opens. Promise me you'll give faith a fighting chance. And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance, I hope you'll dance. Have you heard that one? I hope you'll dance. I hope you never fear those mountains in the distance. Never settle for the path of least resistance. Loving might mean taking chances, but they're worth taking. Loving might be a mistake, but it's worth making. Don't let some hell-bent heart leave you bitter. When you come close to selling out, reconsider. Give the heavens above more than just a passing glance. And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance, I hope you'll dance. Well, I'd heard that song. Leanne Womack sang it. It was the song of the year in country music and the song of the year in pop music, and it's one of the most significant songs that's ever been written in the last 20 years. So imagine sitting around a campfire. This girl says, oh, hey, by the way, I wrote this. And I do okay in front of people like this, but one-on-one, I'm really bad. They don't even let me go to the hospitals to visit people because I just say the wrong things. Well, you're looking really bad today. Can I pray for you? You know, that type thing. And so Josh let me get away, and I went over to this Tia Sillers, and I said, wow, that was a really nice song. Did it take you long to write that? I hope you write another one like that. Well, she's written several, you know. And it's like she's looking at me like, who are you, and how did Brent let you into this place? I'm crying. Made an impact on me just to hear it. I almost cry every time I read the words because it says so much. I hope you'll dance. Went to a dance not long ago. We put on a dance at our church called the Luke 14 Dance, and it's for special needs kids and adults, and we have a special needs ministry. And this year, I went to it, and there were about 400, 500 people, and it was so fun watching them dance, watching their family members on the side. And I was standing with a lady and her daughter, Down syndrome, and she was just so enjoying herself at this dance. And they all were. It was like abandonment out there. It was just total chaos, and everybody was loving it. And I pointed out to her, I said, you know what? I said, sometimes I wonder if the awe and innocence that they have is a greater quality of life than what I have. And she said, you know, here's what's interesting. She said, one of my friends one time said to me, if you could give her a normal pill, would you? And she said, no way. No way. Because her quality of life is so incredible. She said, now my 16-year-old, I'd give him a normal pill tomorrow, okay? But that's a whole nother deal. This awe and this innocence. You know, you're in a series called I Want a Better Life, and the better life that Jesus has for us, in fact, he said in John 10, he said, I've come that you might have life and that you have it more abundantly. Where is abundant life? Is it in the abundance of things? No. Would you agree that most of life is lived between your ears? And Jesus said, I've come that you might have a better life. And part of that life is this sense of awe and innocence that comes when you come to Jesus, when you come to God, when you submit your life to Him. In the beginning, God intended for innocence and awe. The Garden of Eden was about innocence and awe. Adam and Eve walking in the garden, I can only imagine without all the junk. And just walking with God in purity and in innocence. And then you know what happened? Sin came in. And it destroyed it. And there was distance between God, and they knew that they were naked, and it wasn't a good thing. And then, you know, lasciviousness down through time was replaced the innocence that God intended. And then Jesus came. The gospel restores awe and innocence as Jesus lives a sinless life and he dies for your sin and my sin, and then he raises again, proving that he is God and he ascends to the Father, sitting at the right hand of the Father. And if we receive him, we are restored to a place of innocence and awe. And some of you know what that's like. Some of you know what it's like because it's freshly happened to you, and you just cannot believe that God would forgive your sin, and there's just this sense of awe and wonder and innocence. But you know what? We lose that. Jesus told his followers, he said, if you're going to enter my kingdom, you've got to become as a child. And a part of that childlike faith is this innocence and this awe in our relationships with one another and in our relationship with God. If you're going to be a Christ follower, you got to learn to dance. So where do we lose it? When do we quit dancing? Let me just real quickly, I've just got a few minutes. I want to talk about what robs you of innocence and awe, and then maybe a couple of ideas about how to restore it. What robs you of innocence and awe? The first thing, it's what I call the applause. The applause. I want to do an experiment real quick. I'm going to count to three, and I want you to applause as if you were at an LSU game and they just scored the final touchdown to win the national championship. I want you to whistle. I want you to applause. I want you to let it go. One, two, three. Let's go for it. Woo! Yeah! Woo! Yeah! Woo! That was weak, but if it was South Carolina, it probably would have been stronger. You know what I mean? Felt good though, didn't it? Just to applaud, just let it. What if, let me ask you this. What if they did that every time you did something well? Every time Pastor Dino preached, and at the end, as soon as he got the prayer out, you guys just, yeah, and you just ripped one out like you would at the stadium. That was awesome, Pastor. I bet he'd preach better. I bet he would, don't you? What if every time you made a sale or you finished a report, or you changed a diaper, okay? You changed a diaper, and the kids went, Mom, that was awesome! Dad, that was great! Oh, wow! And they're whistling, and they're applauding, and that doesn't happen at your house, huh? Applause is good. It's a good thing. But there's a dangerous element in applause. Proverbs 27, verse 21 says, the crucible for silver and the furnace for gold, but people are tested by their praise. They're tested by their praise. I remember the first time it happened to me, the first time when I spoke in it and people listened and it seemed as if God was pleased and people were moved and I remember how much in awe that I was that God would use me. That God would use me. And then over time we perfect our craft. As preachers, we read books, we study, we pray, we get more swings at the plate. And we hear the applause of the crowd, and it does something to us. We start to believe it. We start to take it for ourselves. For me, it's things like, great message, Pastor. For you, it's, you know, you really do that well. When you sing, when you teach, when you relate, when you sell, when you build, when you draw, when you write, whatever it is that you do, boy, you do that well. And that's a good thing for people to say that, and don't withhold it from others. But we start to believe it. And we take the applause for ourselves. And over time, we lose the amazement that God would actually use us. And instead of that, we start to feeling entitled. Entitled to more. More money. More prestige. More position. Because, hey, I'm good. I'm really working at this. And so-and-so doesn't work as hard as I do. They're not as experienced as, what do you mean they got the position? I deserve it. Let me tell you something. When entitlement starts, gratefulness goes out the door. And you lose the blessing of God, and you lose the sense of awe and wonder. The applause. There's a lot we could say about that, but let me give you another word. The grind takes away a sense of awe and wonder. Would you agree with me that sometimes life can just wear you out? The economy wears you out. Toddlers wear you out. If you're a single parent, just trying to make ends meet can wear you out. Discouraging circumstances, hateful people can wear you out. Paul talks about it in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 8. He says, we are pressed on every side by troubles. I've pastored that church once. We're not crushed, though. We're not broken. We are perplexed. Have you ever been perplexed? It's okay to be perplexed. It's okay even to be discouraged every once in a while. Just don't stay there. I wrote a chapter about that in the book. Some lady in our church gave me a theological point that's helped me so much. Let me just give it to you. She said, it's okay to sit on the pity potty, so long as you don't sit there long enough to get ring around the hiney. Yeah, that's good. Write that down. Will you write that down? And sometimes you get there, you know, and it's going to happen. It's the grind. It's the grind. You don't feel like dancing. So what do you do about the grind? How do you deal with the grind? Well, you go to God. Well, I know you go to God. I go to God all the time. But sometimes you need more than that. You say, more than God? Yeah. If it was just you and God, you're the only one he would have created on the planet. But he created a plethora of relationships. You need other people. You find a group of people who can walk you through it. Would you agree, when you face life alone, you spend too much time in your own head? Have you ever done that? Have you ever spent too much time in your own head? And you start thinking crazy thoughts? Thoughts that there's not enough to go around? Thoughts that I'll never be able... You put it in. You know, anytime it starts with I'll never be able to, or it won't, it's probably not a God thought. But boy, we obsess on them and we think about them. You spend too much time in your own head. You need people around you that can help you. I've got a small group of men that help me think clearly. Dino Rizzo, he's one of my buddies. I meet with him. In fact, today Mark Clary was saying, can you clear a date in about a month? We need to get the guys together. I love that. I love that. It's not often enough, and they just know me from a distance. I've got a group of men that I meet with every other week in a huddle where we go through God's stuff. And then I've got a small group. I've got a group of three guys that meets on my back porch. These guys, unbelievable. One of them was the CEO of Fisher-Price Toys. You ever heard of that toy company? And one of them was a COO of another major national company. And these guys have had success and they've had tough times. And we meet together on my porch at least once a month, usually more than that. And the agenda is this. We're going to talk about whatever we want to talk about. We talk about politics because we kind of enjoy just talking about it. We talk about life. We talk about Jesus. We pray together for one another. It's not even a Bible study. It's easy to hide behind a Bible study. How do you know that? I mean, Bible studies are good, but sometimes it's easy to hide behind. We're sharing our life together. We've gone through so much. And there have been so many times that one or the other of us has helped pull one of us out of our own head and into truth. I'm pretty sure the grind would have stolen my innocence without them. Here's three things I know about you real quick. Number one, you were created for community. Genesis 2 and verse 18, and the Lord God said to Adam, it is not good for man to be alone. God created Adam, the crown of his creation. And he says, it's not good for you to be alone. Let's see if we can find a helpmeet for you. And so he prayed. Look at this. In the Bible, he paraded all the animals in front of Adam. He's going, anything strike your fancy there? Adam goes, well, the aardvark's all right, but the nose thing is kind of off-putting. God said, let me fix you up. So he goes to sleep, and he takes a rib, and he creates Eve, and Eve becomes his helpmeet because he needed somebody, and he didn't just need a wife. He needed the relationships around him. You were created. You are biologically wired up for relationship. Why do you think 400 million people are on Facebook? Because we're looking for relationship. Here's the second thing I know. Our society works against community. Our society works against community. Did you know, I was looking this up, one of the biggest community destroyers over the last 20 years, 30 years, it's been created, is the garage door opener. Did you know that? You used to come home, sit on the front porch, you know, talk to the neighbors as they went by, you had a little bit of community. Now, we come home to our fenced kingdom, we shut the garage door after we put the car in, we spend the evening watching shows about community, and then we go to bed. That's what we do. This was interesting. I saw this the other day in a magazine, that professional coaches were talking about how difficult it is to create team chemistry and community, and they were saying that the biggest hindrance to that was iPods. Because it used to be what they do is when teams would have some time to hang together, they'd talk together, they'd develop community in a sense. Now they get their music on their iPod, slap on the Dr. Dre's, you know, and they're in their own world until they get to the point where they come to play. And the coaches were saying, we don't know how to deal with this. Can I tell you, this isn't going to change anytime soon. This is the world that we live in. Our society works against close personal relationships. Recent study by the American Sociological Review said that Americans have one-third fewer close friends than two decades ago. Did you get that? 30% less close friends than 20 years ago. And the number of people who have none has more than doubled. He goes on, this is a sign we may be living lonelier lives, you think? We are in an epidemic of loneliness. Some of you here today are in a big crowd, and you're lonely. You weren't made to live that way. Here's the third thing I know about you. You've got to be intentional to experience community. See, Jesus hung out with a small group of men intentionally for 3 years. He had 12 guys in his small group, and it was not unlike small groups that we have today. I mean, some relationships were easy. John, the disciple, whom he loved. Some relationships were harder. Some were absolute knuckleheads. He would teach and teach. You read the scriptures on servanthood. I believe he even bought him a copy of Servolution by Dino Rizzo. Guys, read this. And he would teach him. And then a couple of them would get him by himself and say, by the way, Jesus, can we have the best seats in the house when you get to where you're going? And then some in the groups were EGRs. You know what EGRs are? Extra grace required. You've got them in your groups. They say the wrong things at the wrong time. You know, Peter was always, put his foot in his mouth, you know. You just have to deal with it. You got EGRs in your group that you hope when you invite somebody new, they're not going to say something stupid. Jesus had those. If you don't know, I'm sorry. If you don't know who the EGR is in your group, guess who it probably is? Chew. Every group has them. You don't kick them out. They're extra grace required. These 12 men grew to love each other over 3 years. And then Jesus prays for them. Last words to them as he's getting ready to meet his crucifixion and then be ascended into heaven. John 17, look at it. I am praying not only for these disciples, but also for all who will ever believe in me because of their testimony. So who's he praying for? Raise your hand, it's you. He's praying for them and all who would ever believe because of the testimony which is written down in the Bible of these guys. He's praying for them. Here's what he says. My prayer for you is that they will be one. Just as you and I are one, Father. That just as you and I are in me and I am in you, so they will be in us and the world will believe that you sent me. He prays that we would experience something amazing, something that Jesus had experienced with the Trinity from the very beginning of time. True community. True relationship. The Trinity enjoyed each other. They encouraged each other. They cheered each other on. They supported each other. They loved one another. They deferred to one another. You know, what's not to like about that? And Jesus' prayer was that we would experience life-giving relationships just like that with one another. And then he says the stakes are high. It's not an option. He says the reason I want them to experience that is so that the world will know that you sent me. In fact, Francis Schaeffer says our relationship with each other is the criterion that the world uses to judge whether our message is truthful. Christian community is the final apologetic. When you have a group of Christians in a church or a church community that they're not in community. Churches in a city that criticize one another. That talk about one another. You can talk about wanting to win the world all you want to, but you have just destroyed it. Jesus' method for evangelism was that we would be in such community, that we would love one another, that we would be one so that the world could be one. The stakes are high. That's why I love this church. When they asked me to come speak, I said, what series are you in? They said, we're in a series where we're talking about small group. I want to challenge you guys, get in a group. You've got to be intentional. They're making it so easy for you. Yeah, I think you sign up somewhere and they even give you Pastor Dino on video. How cool is that? You say, well, I've tried small groups and they just didn't work. I didn't really find community. You know what? I've gone to restaurants where the food wasn't good, but I kept eating. I didn't quit eating the rest of my life. I just found another restaurant. And I'll bet they'll give you the liberty to find a new group. Would you do that? Is that okay and fair? Yeah. Stay after it. Be intentional. Your future and the future of the world depends on it. You're going to beat the grind. All right. I got a minute and 24 seconds, and I have one more point, and we got to get to it. All right. Here we go. Three things, the applause, the grind, your sin. Your sin will keep you from innocence, obviously. I love David. He's one of my favorite characters in the Bible because he's real. He's not perfect. How many of you sin? It's a real pure area right here. I'm just going to hang out with you guys. Okay, I'm just going to hang out with you. David was world-class in a couple areas. He's a world-class dancer. World-class dancer. He's also a world-class sinner, unfortunately, and it cost him a lot. But he knew, he understood how to not get derailed permanently. And let me just read that. There was a season of his life when he lost the ability to dance. He lost his awe and innocence. Psalm 32 and verse 1 says, oh, what joy for those whose rebellion is forgiven, whose sin is put out of sight. Yes, what joy for those whose record the Lord has cleared of sin, whose lives are lived in complete honesty. When I refused to confess my sin, I was weak and miserable, and I groaned all day long. Day and night, your hand of discipline was heavy on me. My strength evaporated like the water in the summer heat. Finally, I confessed all my sins to you and stopped trying to hide them. And I said to myself, I will confess my rebellion to the Lord, and you forgave me. And look at this, all my guilt is gone. David said, when I refused to confess my sin, I was weak and miserable and I groaned all day long. You know what? It's tough to dance when you're in sin. It's hard to keep being king when you are consumed by sin. In fact, the strongest sin is hidden sin. He says, what joy for those whose record the Lord has cleared of sin, whose lives are lived completely honestly. How do you live that way? It's the spiritual discipline of confession. You need safe people who you can confess your sin to. Richard Foster says this, you need people that there is nothing that anyone can say that will disturb them, nothing. By living under the cross, they can hear the worst possible things from the best possible people without so much as batting an eyelash. I'll be honest with you, a lot of you are Catholic background. I think we in the Protestant church have lost a lot when we swept the whole confession thing out. We need to confess sin. If you don't confess sin, you say, well, I'm confessing to God. Sometimes we do, but you're hiding things from others. And what you hide can destroy you and will destroy you. We need to learn to confess our sin. What if my confession could cost me my job? Well, or my marriage or whatever. You know, the options are fake it, live a lie, and never really dance again. And I've lived long enough to know chances are you're going to face the music someday. And the longer you go, the messier it gets. Or do what David did is and confess it and stop hiding. So you can't control the consequences, but you can control your response. In the Ark, we plant churches, and a few months ago, we had one of our church planters who had a major moral failure. And this is a guy that was very, very, I guess he had a following. And he was actually living a lie because he was saying bad things about people who were actually in the sin that he was involved in. Finally, the misery of his sin led him to confess to a friend. And my friend had to break the news to a heartbroken congregation that their pastor was going to have to resign because of the sin that he was involved in. And he stepped down and he started a long process of restoration. This week I talked to my pastor friend who's kind of overseeing him. I said, how's he doing? He said, you know, I think he's doing good. He's willing to do the hard work to prepare to dance again. Some people short-circuit the process. Preachers do that. They confess themselves healed way before they are. And then they begin to minister not out of brokenness, but out of woundedness. There's a difference. I don't have time to talk about that. You need to minister out of a brokenness, but not out of woundedness, or you will wound people all around. What was interesting is the first guy that responded to this guy that fell, first responder, kind of the triage guy, was one who had been crippled by his own sin, but he took the time to heal. And now he is back in the dance with a sense of innocence. In awe. See, God doesn't get any glory by permanently putting you on the shelf. He specializes in turning crucifixions into resurrections. Jesus loves to ruin a good funeral. I love it. It's great. So if you're trapped in sin, don't let the fear of discovery keep you permanently out of the dance. God wants to walk you to walk in innocence and awe. So let me close with this. Some of you are just starting to dance. Some of you may have come today And you want to enter into a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. And I want to challenge you to do that. Because when you do, when you confess your sin and you say, I want to follow you, there is such a sense of innocence that comes over you. A sense of awe that God would forgive all of my sins. And some of you are there, and I want to challenge you, just protect it. Some of you don't dance much anymore. You've been seduced by the applause or discouraged by the grind. You've been sidetracked by your own sin. I want to challenge you to get back into the dance. Some of you, your next step is to get into a small group. For some of you, it's to confess sin to a small group of people and say, help me, hold me accountable. We need you. We need you. And some of you, you're like me. You've been dancing a long time. Maybe you're a grandpa or a grandma. I got a word for you. God save the best dance to last. Some of you have been thinking, my time has passed. Maybe the best years are the last years. No, the best years are the rest of the years. God has a dance for you. Let's bow for prayer. Father, I thank you today for your kingdom, for your work in our lives. God, I just pray right now that you would draw us into your presence. God, that some of us would just say yes to you right now in this moment. Maybe that's a yes to following you for the first time. Say yes to God. Maybe that's a yes, I'm returning to you. Maybe that's a yes, God, I'm going to quit covering my sin. I'm going to confess it. God, restore me and help me. For some of us, that's a yes to community. Saying, you know what, I'm going to be a part of the core of what's happening in your church today. Some are saying yes to a future. And God, I pray that your kingdom would come and your will would be done. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening. For more information about Healing Place Church, go to healingplacechurch.org or give us a call at 225-753-2273.